Welcome to the Dreameam. I'm Sasha Smulders.
I'm Joe Foljam. This is The Sandman, issue 57, The Kindly Ones, part 1. So this is The Kindly Ones, part 1, but before that happens, there's a short story called The Castle.
Bonus comic for you.
This showed up as part of a little comic collection. Like, it was basically a single issue that I think they gave out free or for cheap to comic shops. It had a selection of stories and short stories from different Vertigo comics, and it was called Vertigo Jam Number 1. And the Sandman part of this was this little short story called The Castle, which is, it feels like it was taken from what's in issue 1 and kind of redone to be its own little standalone.
Yeah.
That's also like a kind of an introduction for anybody who might be new.
Yeah.
It feels like, hey, if you're going to start reading The Sandman at this issue, this will catch you up on who the people in the Dreaming are.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's get into that.
Yeah, I right off the bat identify very strongly with the character of the huge faceless women with wolves astride.
Yeah.
Who chew at entrails and legs and have sharp teeth.
Yeah, I thought you would like them.
Yeah, they're basically my new fave. Like, when in doubt,
I think that's your next
live your truth.
Your next cosplay should be one of them.
Yeah, I'm sure I'll really have a great time covering my nose and eyes and then navigating the world. I guess I have to cover my mouth too and make a fake mouth to make it that big and perfect.
Yeah, I'm totally for that, covering your mouth up.
Rude.
I mean, yeah. That's the joke. The faceless women, I tried to find a mythological reference for this. Japan has some faceless myths, but I don't think this ties into anything directly. It's a little bit kind of like the Maenads who tore apart Orpheus.
Ah.
Right, in that they're, you know, wild women running with wolves and threatening to eat him and stuff like that. But I think it's mostly just a scary dream.
Mm.
Like, that was the right dream. And then he wakes up and gets mistaken for a visitor at the castle.
He wakes up and then goes back to sleep.
Yeah, he wakes up and then goes back to sleep.
Yeah.
And as he's sleeping he instead of going back to his right dream, he ends up as in the castle and gets mistaken for a visitor, it looks like.
What I like is that in his faceless woman dream,
mm-hmm.
Them gnawing and biting at him and pulling his entrails, that's not what's horrifying. It doesn't become horrifying until he tries to push her head off of him.
Mm-hmm.
And then his hand just kind of goes through her thin skull and he realizes that she doesn't have a brain.
Yeah.
That's when it actually becomes horrifying.
Yeah, I begin to thrash and scream desperately, and that's when he wakes up. So you're here for the tour, eh? You don't look anything like I expected you to. Well, not to worry. Anywhere in particular you wish to begin? No. Very well. And then Lucien introduces the Dreaming Library.
The super library.
The library of every book that's never been written.
The library of, hold on to that handrail because
yeah,
things are about to get real Star Wars if you fall off that.
It's a long way down.
Ooh.
I'm imagining if we shot this in a movie or something today, that those books would be moving up and down so that, and like wherever you stepped, probably something safe would get in the way of your foot. It could be some weird Hogwartsian kind of magic going on. And again, maybe it's a dangerous castle.
Or you just fall.
Yeah.
Whoops.
Ah! Oh, yeah, there are a lot of falling dreams, aren't there?
Yeah, and then you wake up.
Falling through a library.
I can only imagine if I was dreaming that reading these books in this library would be so aggravating because I don't know if you know anything about lucid dreaming, but when you try to read in a dream, that's how you know that you're dreaming, mm-hmm. is that the words don't make sense. And when you look back, they change.
Oh, terrible.
Because our brains aren't really that good at constructing written word.
Right.
Like, while dreaming. Apparently, he has every book that's ever not been written.
Right.
Including the book of our protagonist here, which is called The Best-Selling Romantic Spy Thriller I Used to Think About on the Bus That Would Sell a Billion Copies and Mean I'd Never Have to Work Again.
Mm-hmm.
Catchy title.
Mm-hmm. Lucien also notes he ran across a book recently which suggested that the peace and prosperity of a culture was solely related to how many librarians it contained. I think that's kind of an important point. I think it's true in a lot of ways. He thinks it's a bit of a stretch, but librarians are about making sure that your culture remembers things and like everything. Their job is to remember for everybody. so that if anybody else comes along, they can find out that knowledge, right? They're the keepers of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Cultures that don't value that mean that they don't value knowledge. And yeah. Knowledge is an incredible power, especially across, you know, civilization-sized competitions. So I think, I mean, it's kind of a throwaway here, but it's also a recognition of the truth of that.
I think that's true as long as you also consider folks who carry on oral history to be librarians in that sense, because there are countless indigenous cultures around the world who carry like a rich oral history that's super important to
right.
them.
Right. If,
yeah, if we consider them librarians of a sense, then
the,
yes.
The keepers of the knowledge, yeah. For sure. Yeah, absolutely. That if you don't, it doesn't necessarily have to be in book form, although uh-huh. I think the advantage of the book form is if the person who is, you know, has it in their head is gone, you still have the book.
Absolutely.
So it's like a backup for sure. Yeah, there are people scrambling to make sure that cultures that exist that way are not forgotten
mm-hmm.
by somehow taking that and archiving that as well. And those librarians are also very important.
Yeah.
Yeah, librarians are a big deal. Even librarians for books that were never written, like all those awesome ones that I could have written and I haven't.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Neil has the smallest amount of not written books in the library. That jerk. How dare he keep books out of the library of Lucien by actually writing books. Take that, Neil Gaiman, and your talent.
Do you think there's like a separate library, but it's like a theater and it's just filled with unfinished burlesque acts?
Right.
Because like, it should stand that yes. It works for every creative endeavor. So yes. Unpainted paintings and untaken, undeveloped photographs.
Yes. Uncreated websites, for sure. All of it. Uncreated games.
Yes.
All the games that nobody ever made.
Yeah.
That they were sure they could have made. Whatever it is, it exists in the library of things that aren't.
Mm.
It's the advantage of dreaming. Then Lucien kind of goes into a little bit of a history lesson, and Merv Pumpkinhead helps out.
There you go again, Lush. You can't just come right out and say it, huh? Now me, I'm a straightforward kind of guy, you know? I mean, some of us aren't afraid to call a spade a goddamn shovel. The saying is called a spade a spade. So
yeah.
Right there, he points out that he lies. I'm not afraid to hyperbolize a situation.
But he doesn't use the fancy word spade. A spade ain't a spade, it's a shovel. It's a goddamn shovel.
Well, no, a spade is a very, very small hand shovel, and a shovel is a big thing. So he is also saying, I'm not afraid to call this thing that is this thing and explode it out of proportion to suit my storytelling needs.
Yeah, so the accuracy of it is not his forte.
So he retells the story of how Dream was all locked up. He also gets into talking about painting the sky. Hey, it's been good talking to you, you know? Hey, some of us have got jobs to be getting on with. I mean, real jobs, not like just watching libraries and nothing. Hey, get your head out of the clouds! Not you, kiddo. I was talking to Tiny. He gets his head in the clouds, he'll be sneezing for days. I don't know what that accent was, but I kind of like it.
I liked it too.
I love when he yells, get your head out of the clouds.
Mm-hmm.
His whole pumpkin head splits in half and you can see the broomstick that's yep. sticking through.
Yes. Yeah, he's just a weird twig man with a pumpkin head.
Mm-hmm.
Good old Merv.
Well, his hands are sticks too, and so his mm-hmm. fingers are empty gloves.
Yep.
So anytime his hand's not actually like holding something, the fingers just flop.
Yep. Yeah, he's perfect. I look forward to seeing Andy Serkis play Merv Pumpkinhead at some time.
Uh-huh.
He's the motion capture guy who does all the awesome motion capture.
Uh-huh. But what about the face?
They do his face. They capture his face for, like, Planet of the Apes stuff.
Oh, cool.
They do the same, and then they would translate it to weirdo pumpkin face. And then we meet Nuala, who was a fairy gift during Season of Mists. They bribed Dream. Here, we'll give you this this elf maiden. It's all yours. Have her. It's kind of weird. And he was like, okay.
Doesn't let her be pretty and doesn't give her anything to do. So now she just cleans this place all the time because She had nothing else to do.
Yeah. Well, we don't get that yet. It's not until The Kindly Ones, which is...
Oh, sorry. I was taking pages. The two stories and putting them together in my head.
Exactly. But they're very similar, right? This bit is kind of repeated. But in this, she doesn't say that she's cleaning because she has nothing else to do. In this, it feels like she's being told to clean. It's a little sadder looking.
Yeah.
Yeah. She says she doesn't miss Fairy at all, but she obviously really does. And then Matthew the Raven shows up. He talks a little bit about himself. He hasn't always been a raven. Used to be a guy. He lives with Eve in their cave.
And he says he's not sure what happened to the other ravens, mm-hmm. which I think is just foretelling of his curiosity in the next story as well.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a thing that he's been thinking about. And then we meet Abel of Cain and Abel, who knows about secrets. His brother knows mysteries.
They're over there by the graveyard, the houses. See, they look after us. My brother's name is Cain. We're very best friends in the whole world. In the whole wide world.
Oops.
Tosses him right off a balcony.
Yeah, I feel this splits a little. It's hard to line these two up. Abel has already fallen all the way down. The only thing kind of tying it is the handkerchief and like it rotates around. This is just a little art pickiness here.
I actually like it.
Okay.
Quite a bit. But they do, yeah, it is a little hard to tell they're in the same place, but I actually do like it quite a bit.
But there's no Cain beginning to fall over.
No.
It's just him leaning and a hand behind him and then completely gone.
Yeah.
So I think I would have liked it a little, maybe one more frame or something like that.
Hmm. Or maybe if Goldie was still kind of in the picture.
Yeah. Yeah,
Goldie was flying.
Hovering there. Yeah, that would do it.
Yeah.
And then Morpheus shows up. Lucian says, yeah, I'm showing your guest around. He's like, does this look like my guest to you, Lucian?
Ah, oh dear.
Well, no matter. So you have shown a dreamer the castle. It will do no harm. And have you learned anything from your visit to my palace, mortal dreamer? No. Well, all of you come here sooner or later. This palace is the heart of all your dreaming, after all. But you have seen very little, mortal dreamer. Would you like to stay longer? After all, there are 1,000,000 other sights to see here in the dreaming, and many things to learn.
But he's saved by the bell.
Yep.
This was Zach Morris the whole time, in case you were wondering.
Zach Morris?
Sorry, it's a Saved by the Bell reference to my 90s kid friends.
Wow. Wow. It's his wake-up call, and he forgets the dream. Some kind of weird dream. I don't even remember what it was now. Oh, well. It couldn't have been that important. It was only a dream, after all. That's why Dream's like, yeah, it doesn't matter if he's seen the castle. He'll just think it's a dream.
What would he do with that information anyway?
Yeah, exactly.
If he was like, no, that was real.
Write a comic book called The Sandman about a Lord of Dreams who lives in a castle. Bum, bum, bum.
You've okay. cracked the code.
I have cracked the code.
You've solved Neil's dream puzzle.
Yep.
You were awarded $1 million dream dollars.
So there's the castle. Again, it's a little catch-up. It reveals a little bit more for us. We find out who paints the clouds.
Yes.
Paints the sky. Very important information.
Yes.
And here we go on to the kindly ones. We can see the cover here, which obviously has the three kindly ones together.
Yeah.
I've got a bit of information from Dust Covers about this. Two things. So the way that this is handled is it has Neil's comments and it has Dave's comments. Mm-hmm. I will do Neil's first. The kindly ones sequence was Dave's chance to cut loose with the computer. And more than the computer, to create images that did not quite accede to reason. The only thing I asked for was the cord, line, string, or ribbon on the first two covers. They were far and away the strangest of the covers. I would telephone Dave and talk at him, listing images, emotions, feelings, characters, and somewhere in the bubble he would find his images. So that's Neil talking about how they were made. Sounds a lot easier than what Dave says, because it turns out he had some problems with, especially this one. 57 was started 5 times. Once with a painted composition that I liked as a doodle, but just didn't work in paint. Once with this image scanned and trishened and played within a computer, still no joy. This was dumped. I told DC I was running a bit late. I got depressed and ate ice cream. I was getting a CD-ROM authored, and the guy in charge of the bureau, Simon Banton, was working on deciphering a signature on a drawing using computer-enhanced filtering. The signature looked convincingly like Picasso. He said if he and the owner proved it was a real thing, not a middle period Charlie Picasso, for example, he was up for 10%, but I digress. A print of the drawing hung on the wall and was quite beautiful. I made a small sketch of an idea suggested by the drawing for a way of handling the three figures. Version 3 was a drawn version, version 4 a painting and photo version, and finally this version, by far the best and most fun to do. The clay and wood figures are wrapped in thread, dressed in Thai silk, and collaged with sepia-toned photographs. This was lit with projected slides and photographed, scanned, and touched up in Photoshop.
Cool. Yeah, you can definitely tell it's a 3D creation.
Mm-hmm. So this was, wooden clay models, silk, photography, and Mac.
The top left doll looks like Wonder Woman.
A little, yeah.
Wonder Woman.
I think that fits.
Yeah.
The tape seems to be medieval German, and someone via the Sandman annotations has identified it as being from Nibelungenlied, the saga that Wagner drew on for his ring cycle.
Oh.
So it's a very old story wrapped around them.
The Ring of Nibelung.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the Die of Valkyrie comes from.
There you go.
Ride of the Valkyries.
The Kindly Ones is a translation of the Greek Eumenides. They're terrifying hags who pursue those who slay their own kin. They're also named the Furies, and they're called kindly as a euphemism. The term that Wikipedia seems to prefer for them is Erinyes. They were sometimes referred to as infernal goddesses.
Hmm.
And Neil has presented them before several times throughout the Sandman. We've seen them. They've showed up to answer questions.
Yeah.
You get three questions with them and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
And then they eat you. They don't eat you. Well, they might eat you if you're a mouse and you ask them questions.
Yeah. And page one, we see them. The triple goddess. Mother, maiden, and crone. These are the kindly ones.
They begin with a ball of yarn.
Mm-hmm.
The youngest passes it on to the middle one.
The mother, yeah.
The mother.
Maiden hands it to the mother.
And she begins knitting. And she's not sure what she's making.
Yeah.
Could be a poet in a lovely scarf, or a fisherman with his special woolly sweater, or a hunter in his nice thick socks.
And we hear a little about their different personalities. The mother loves making the stuff, and oh, it's so wonderful, and who knows what you're going to get. And the crone is like, nah, give me endings.
Yeah, meh. I don't like it. Meh.
Can't say I've ever been too fond of beginnings myself. Messy little things. Give me a good ending anytime. You know where you are with an ending. Which is odd that we're here at a beginning of a giant new chapter of this story. I mean, these are some big deals happening in the Kindly Ones already, and I think Neil's setting us up for that. And they argue back and forth about it. The mother likes it. The crone's meh.
Yeah, she thinks it's messy. That you don't know where you're going, you don't know what you're going to end up with. Well, that's messy. And all these people, they just complain anyway.
And I love the complain thing. It's very fitting right now because this isn't just about the life that you get. To me, this is also a creator talking about continuing to create things and starting new chapters in the thing that you're creating, which is what Neil's doing here with the Sandman.
Mm-hmm.
And it ties right into The Last Jedi that just got released. Because you could say this about the people. It's never what they want. And if we give them what they think they want, they like it less than ever. I never thought it would be like this. Why can't it be like the one I had before? I don't know why we bother.
Hmm.
That feels like an author continuing to make great work. But people are like, oh, it's not as good as that first one.
Yeah.
Why isn't this just good like it used to be? Stop making the new kind of good.
Right.
Yeah.
Or I hate it because it's too much like the old one.
Yeah, which we heard about The Force Awakens. I know. I loved The Last Jedi, and I do not agree with almost any of the criticisms. Let's not do a Star Wars podcast, but yeah, I'll argue with you on the internet.
You were on a podcast and talked about Star Wars. Why don't you?
I did.
How about you mention that?
Yeah, I actually was on as a guest on a podcast called Politicoast. And you can listen to that at politicoast.ca. I can put the links in the show notes.
Yeah.
Mention it on all the social things. But they wanted to talk about the politics and military strategy of Star Wars. And I'm a giant nerd. So I was their giant nerd expert. It was fun.
They've decided to have tea, and in the cupboard there's ginger snaps, Florentine, sponge cake, and fortune cookies.
And a mouse in the trap.
And a dead mouse.
Yeah.
So the maiden wants ginger snaps, the mother wants a fortune cookie, and the crone is happy to have the mouse.
And they open a fortune. The maiden reads it out.
A king will forsake his kingdom. Life and death will clash and fray. The oldest battle begins once more.
We've had that one before, haven't we? And we have. Do you remember when?
Yeah, that's the one with Lucifer.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Season of Mists, that was the prediction that would happen for him.
Mm-hmm.
And it came true.
Mm-hmm.
And we get it again. Repeating themes.
Yeah.
Repeating prophecies.
Right, I think that one's gone on long enough.
Do you think so? I rather like this one. I thought maybe it could be a little longer.
You're too soft, both of you. Much too soft.
Snip. And that's it. Whoever's life that is, it's over.
Yeah. So they cut the string with the big scissors.
Yep. That's the string of your fate, the thread of life.
Mm-hmm. When the Furies were depicted in Disney's Hercules, the animated film, they had a gold cord. Or it was a regular cord. It became a gold cord when Hercules became a god. And then suddenly they couldn't cut through it anymore.
Okay.
Yeah, it was the same kind of cord. It wasn't a ball of yarn. They were on a spinning wheel. They were making it on a spinning wheel.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have seen the movie, but I think only the once. And I don't love it like a lot of people do, because it wasn't important for me. But I know it's a big deal for you.
The music is very good. Mm-hmm. There are a bunch of flaws in the storytelling of mm-hmm. it, so I can understand why. Like, yeah. Lindsay Ellis has a great YouTube thing where she talks about the failings of it and where it didn't actually land the points they were trying to make with the movie, and so how it fell apart. But otherwise, there's so much about it that's really great. So, you know, go check out Lindsay Ellis on YouTube.
I can put that link in the show notes mm-hmm. if you give it to me.
I will.
And then over the page, we are back with Lita Hall, who we haven't seen for quite some time.
Mm-hmm. I think this is a good point to interject, too. The art is very different in this
particular... Yeah.
Issue.
I haven't done the credits. You're totally right. Let me do the credits now. Neil Gaiman, writer, Dave McKean, of course, did the cover. Artist on this is Mark Hempel. Mark Hempel at the time was known for doing a series with DC called Breathtaker that was very artistic. I would say it would have been done as a Vertigo comic had it been done nowadays. It was excellent. And one of my favorites is his own personal project, Gregory, which is about a little kid who is living in a straitjacket in a home to take care of him because he can't take care of himself. And if he is out of his straitjacket, he runs around and causes all sorts of problems. And his art is very, I like to call it graphic designy.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's very straight line, but they're a little shaggy at the same time.
This is my favorite out of, I think, any artistic rendition we've had on any of his books. This is actually my favorite.
I love that you say that, because the art in The Kindly Ones from Mark Hempel is really controversial. A lot of people hate his art here.
I can see why people would hate it. I love it.
I do too.
It looks really modern to me.
Yeah.
It looks really good. The colors look really good.
It's iconic. Like, he draws the lines to get the emotional impact you need while still making them very recognizable characters.
Mm-hmm.
There's no extra busy work going on. It's all there. I super love it.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's my hot take. This is my favorite out of all of the art styles of all Excellent. Of the Sandman.
Yeah. I think there are panels out of this that I would love to have just giant blown up art pieces on the wall.
Yeah.
I'll very specifically mention one that I think is about 6 in or so that I've actually turned into a t-shirt myself.
Hmm.
I adore it. Yeah, I love Mark Hempel's art. I love the coloring here, which is, we'll keep going on. Daniel Vazzo is the colorist. He's done great work throughout the entire series. Todd Klein, the letterer, throughout the entire series as well. Karen Berger, the editor, and Shelley Bond, the associate editor. Lita's son, Daniel, who... Let's catch up. Jess stated in a dream world that was created by Brute and Glob, some nightmares that worked for the Sandman,
mm-hmm.
after Morpheus was stuck in that glass bubble for 60 or 70 years.
Yeah.
So Daniel, something's going on with Daniel.
Well, Morpheus came to collect him, didn't he?
He said, I will. One day I will come for him, he said. The child is mine.
Yes.
And she said, you'll take him over my dead body.
Yes.
Yeah. The Fury. That was her name, by the way, as a superheroine, mm-hmm. was The Fury.
And it was also her mother's name.
Yeah. So her background is very odd. She's had a couple of different backstories because they keep redoing the universe. At one point, she was the daughter of another universe's Wonder Woman, the Wonder Woman that was active during World War II, mm-hmm. had a daughter, and that was her. But then they made it so they wiped that whole universe and said, no, Wonder Woman's only been here since she just showed up and doesn't know anything about man's world. So there couldn't have been a Wonder Woman back then to be your mother. So they gave her a whole other backstory, which was that she was adopted by the Trevors.
Yes.
Yeah. So her backstory is mutable. Neil is able to take it and, yeah, play with it mm-hmm. as he wants to here. It seems like she's got a tie to the Furies, right? That's not a coincidence that she's involved in this story. The kindly ones, the Furies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Daniel's causing trouble in that there's sand in the bed.
Mm-hmm. In a comic called The Sandman.
Yeah, where did he get this sand? I guess when he's dreaming, he goes places, perhaps?
Yeah.
Her friend is there with her and is trying to calm her down and suggest Carla. They go... Carla?
Carla is her friend, yeah.
Carla. And suggest they go out for ice cream.
Yeah, Carla's saying he maybe he's just been playing in a sandbox and he hasn't been playing in a sandbox. Mm-hmm. So, and you notice her reaction is to get mad.
Yeah.
The Fury gets mad.
Oh, yeah.
She's got a temper on her.
She gets mad at Daniel quite a few times in this for things he has no control over.
Yeah.
He's a kid.
He's a little kid. She's a Fury.
Mm-hmm.
But they do go out for ice cream. And a man comes walking around. He seems to be giving away flowers. And he seems to be kind of mashing up a couple of nursery rhymes. I think most of us will know the nursery rhyme of... Hey, diddle, diddle, the cat and the fiddle, the cow jumped over the moon. He starts off with, diddle, diddle, dumpling, my son John went to bed with his trousers on, one shoe off and the other shoe on, diddle, diddle, dumpling, my son John.
Mm.
So it's two different diddle, diddle nursery rhymes that he's pulling from. So he's kind of free associating, I think.
And then what's this little dog laugh to see? What's that from?
I'm pretty sure that's from Diddle, Diddle, Dumpling, John.
Mm. He's writing his own mashup.
Yeah.
Must have been a mighty fine jumper, that old cow. Moon long way up, and it's awful cold. The old man offers Daniel a flower, and Lyda goes full rage on him.
Yeah, grabs him and threatens him.
You get away from my son, or you don't touch my son, understand me?
And he starts crying, because he's just a kind of not all there old man, mm-hmm. trying to give away flowers.
I think it's really interesting, and the dish ran away with the spoon. I think that is also perhaps foreshadowing to what happens at the end of this.
Mm-hmm.
That's the last line of the song that he sings.
Yeah.
While he's looking at Daniel.
There is mention, this looks a little bit like the old man who took care of the island that Orpheus was on.
Oh.
But I think he's too tall.
Mm-hmm.
To be him, but he also does have red flowers, and the red flowers seem like the red flowers from that grew where Orpheus's head was buried.
Yeah,
right, and where the blood dripped off of Dream's hands, mm-hmm. those flowers were there. So it could be a tie together. I don't think it's the same person, but I mean, it could be meant to look like him, and the flowers could be a reference to that as well.
Mm.
Not totally sure what's going on here.
Hmm. But he's clearly around all the time because the friend knows him, mm-hmm. has seen him before.
He's just the old man who's around the neighborhood a lot, giving out flowers or begging for a light or for change. And Lyda acknowledges that she overreacted, or at least asks.
Yeah.
We learn how super overprotective she is. Sometimes when he's sleeping, I go in there and just watch him, listen to him breathe. She's super afraid of, like, leaving him alone. I can see why. The Lord of Dreams has said, I'm going to come for your child and take him someday. So angry superheroine is like, I had better watch over my son all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, also, after everything they've been with, right? Like, been through. She was pregnant with him for an inordinately long amount of time,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yep.
So there's that, like, attachment. And then he's also the last thing that's left of her husband.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, yeah.
But if anything happened to him, if anyone hurt him, if anything happened...
Yeah, I know. If anything happened, you'd just die.
I wouldn't die, Carla. If anyone hurt Daniel, I'd kill them.
And that's the first time her face is, like, really in frame, like, very detailed.
Yeah. And it's a dead serious presentation. She's not lying. She's not being hyperbolic. Mm-hmm. She would kill them. And then we're back to the dreaming.
The kindly ones.
One. And I think there are 13 parts to this
to
get through. It is the longest arc.
Well, if we stick with this art, I'll be very happy about it.
There's a few exceptions because Mark had problems keeping up with the schedule. So I think there's like two issues where there are some guest artists, but he's in for almost all of them. Yeah.
Yay.
Yeah. And it's Matthew who talks to the hippogriff, the wyvern, and the
Pegasus.
And the griffin. They call Pegasus hippogriff in for some reason. Yeah.
Because they haven't read Harry Potter yet.
Well, yeah. Neil insists that he's got some sources that say that that's a hippogriff, I guess. But it's not the common presentation, no. I will note that Pegasus is the name of the winged horse. He's not a Pegasus. The winged horse is named Pegasus.
Oh.
That is true.
Okay.
So, but that has gone on to, you know, like Xerox, meaning to photocopy stuff. That has gone on to be, those are now called Pegasus and the plural is Pegasi and all that kind of stuff.
Mm. Okay. So he asks, is the boss home? And they say yes. And he basically tells him that he can just go in, but he wants to stop and have a conversation with them along the way.
Well, he's been really wondering about the other birds, the other ravens and what goes on and stuff like that. He's finally starting to ask people who work here.
Mm-hmm. But it seems like as a pattern in this little bit here, every time he stops to talk to someone, someone provides him an immediate answer to his first question, but then gets really cagey about everything else he wants to know.
Hmm. Well, they go, were you people or something? And he says, we were always as we are, a griffin, a wyvern, a hippogriff. Yeah? So you've always guarded the door to the castle? We're doorkeepers, Matthew. Which to me means kind of, They are dreams. And so he made them to be that. So that's what they've always been.
Yeah, they weren't anything else before.
No, they weren't anything else. Matthew is different from them. Yeah. We take our strength and our authority from our Lord. When he was imprisoned and powerless, so were we.
Matthew's wondering how they got into it.
Right. There are no griffins, no wyverns, no winged horses in the waking world, Raven. Not anymore. But we are here. It's just a roundabout way of saying we're dreams. We were created by Morpheus, and when he's gone, we're not around. And then he goes in to see him. And on the way, he meets Merv.
Yeah, good old Merv, ready to complain.
Yeah.
Basically complains that Matthew shits on everything.
He complains, even though he literally has a dream job.
That was bad.
You're welcome. So Matthew asks him about the other ravens. Do you remember any of the other ravens before me? Like I'm going to forget them? Always dropping feathers in the hall and shitting on my clean floors. And Jesus, the stuff you birds eat. Not that I'm prejudiced or nothing.
It basically sounds like you're prejudiced there,
yes,
Merv.
Yes, he's totally prejudiced. He's prejudiced against everybody except for himself. But he obviously doesn't know. Like who has time to keep track of you people? Some of us have real jobs, birdie. We all can't perch on the boss's shoulder, live in a cave, eat dead rats, and crap on the floor, right?
But he asks Matt not to tell Dream what they talked about.
Well, this is about the only time he's complained about Morpheus out loud, that Morpheus hasn't shown up behind him as part of a gag.
Yeah.
Really, Mervin? What is it about your job you don't like? This is about the only... So instead, he kind of realizes that and goes, hey, you're not going to tell him what I said, are you? We're just talking, right? And then Nuala, who is cleaning one of the big stained glass windows.
And this one is very similar to that first scene with her, where she was cleaning the statues by the same windows.
In the castle, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And she goes over it again, but that she's cleaning because she wants to, because no one gave her anything else to do.
Very specifically, Lord Morpheus has never asked anything of me. So he got given basically a slave. And he accepted her because it was polite, but doesn't tell her to do anything. But now she's like, I need to do something.
Yeah.
So she's cleaning.
Well, Because in fairy tales, mm-hmm. that's what happens when you don't have power. When you're a young woman, you clean things. You're like Cinderella. Exactly. You clean everything.
Yeah. And again, just the graphical presentation of Mark Hempel here, like how his view pulls back from her and she gets smaller, right? I have to do something. She's just there, and he's using such simple strokes in order to convey all of that. I love it. Another thing I should have probably noted earlier, notice how just about every page is made up of a multiple of three panels. So we're really hitting the three of the three ladies.
Oh.
We've got six panels.
We've got 9 panels on the next page.
We've got 3 panels on the opening kindly ones, 1 big one and 2 smaller ones.
Well, I'll be damned.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
And over to our next one, which actually has 9 panels, 3 by 3, we meet Lucien.
He's reading a book in the library.
Mm-hmm. An unwritten play by John Webster. John Webster was best known for his plays The Duchess of Malfi and The White Devil. And the quote that he gives in panel 2 there is from T.S. Eliot's Whispers of Immortality. Webster was much possessed by death and saw the skull beneath the skin, and breastless creatures underground leaned backward with a lipless grin. It's actually a poem by T.S. Eliot about Webster.
Hmm.
And that's how it starts.
A lipless grin is underground. That's a skeleton.
That's a skeleton, yes.
That's a skeleton.
Yeah. Yeah, you mean he had some kind of x-ray vision? No, nothing like that.
Nope. Just a skeleton, Matthew. Jeez. So it's been a long time since Matthew's seen Dream. Mm-hmm. He's not sure how long because time is weird.
Yeah.
2 months, 6 months, a year. And we find out that Lucien was never alive, or if he was, he doesn't remember it.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember the title, author, and location of every book in this library, Matthew. Every book that's ever been dreamed, every book that's ever been imagined, every book that's ever been lost. Millions upon millions of them. That's what I remember. It's my job. Other things, I forget sometimes. He's down by the shore, Matthew, making nightmares.
Again, another reveal of, listen, probably some of you have been asking, is every single dream a former person like Matthew? And we're finding out, no, that they're not. That it seems like the vast majority of these entities, the hippogriff, right, the wyvern, the griffin, Lucien, they are all dreams.
Yeah.
They are of the dreaming and weren't people before who became this.
Matthew doesn't ask Marv what he was before.
Merv. Probably because it's kind of obvious that a pumpkin-headed man made out of sticks probably didn't used to be a human.
Fair enough.
Right? He makes it. I think he would have noted. Also, he complained he wasn't alive anymore out loud.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you're totally right.
Ah, when I was alive.
And he seems very wrapped up just in the world, the physical world of the dreaming, because that's his job. And so he doesn't seem to care at all about how people on the outside experience it. He doesn't give a crap about that. It's just, I'm told to make stuff, so I make it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mervin's almost like, look, instead of magicking things into existence, it would kind of be funnier and more clever if the dreaming literally had a character who made it sort of happen magically all the time in a weird kind of construction-y way. Yeah. And it still is magic, right? It still is kind of just Morpheus going, this is how it gets made. But he's so powerful at it that it literally creates thinking entities to get the stuff done.
He's like a crotchety old like set designer crew
member. Yeah, totally.
Who's like, yeah, the play's magic, but spent like, you know how long it took me to build that box set with the trap door, right.
This director is so full of himself.
Yeah, the guy who never sees the play.
Yeah.
He builds the sets, he does everything, he paints everything, he does all this stuff, and he never fucking sees the play.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't give a shit.
Yeah. And Morpheus is down by the shore making nightmares.
Another lipless smile.
Yeah, but this time it's in somebody's eye socket. And we find out he's making the Corinthian again.
I made the first one a long time ago, Matthew, before poor Orpheus was born. I crafted him. Now I craft another.
Why?
Why?
That's what I said. Why? I mean, you already had to destroy him once. Seems kind of odd to start him off again.
I created the Corinthian to be the dark mirror of humanity, Matthew. A dark mirror. Imagine that you woke in the night and rose and seemed to see before you another person whom slowly you perceived to be yourself. Someone had entered in the night and placed a mirror on your sleeping place, made from a black metal. You had been frightened only of your reflection. But then the reflection slowly raised one hand while your own hand stayed still. A dark mirror. That was always the intention. But the gulf between conception and execution is wide, and many things can happen on the way.
And Matthew points out quite rightly, I don't think I've ever heard you talk so much, not at one time. That was the most explanation that Dream has really given us about almost anything.
Mm-hmm.
And what he wants to talk about are the flaws in his own creations and how he is dealing with that by recreating it.
Yeah.
He's going to make a better Corinthian. One that's not as bad as the other one, but is still a bad.
Yeah.
Like, he's still a nightmare. It is rare that I return to a previous theme. Aren't you worried?
Of what?
I don't know, of what it's going to do. The last Corinthian tried to kill you.
The last Corinthian was a fool. This one will not be.
No more of that killing people and eating their eyes shit?
The Corinthian was not intended to be a reassuring dream, Matthew.
So why did you destroy it?
Sometimes dreams go bad, Matthew. I have known a few in my time. Certain of them I removed from the body of the dreaming. Others I uncreated.
So we get some more here that his options are many. Dreams can go bad. Some of them he uncreates, some of them he removes from the dreaming altogether.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like when he uncreates, he can recreate.
Yeah.
And he said the previous one was a fool, this one will not be. And we remember that when he uncreated the Corinthian, he was really upset with the simplicity of his kind of horror, right? That he had just joined in on these serial killers and the self-importance that they had.
And that he wanted to take over. Like, he was foolish of him to think he could take over the dreaming.
Yes,
and that
too.
He would team up with the people he teamed up with.
Yeah.
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 So now he'll be so smart that when he goes to take over the dreaming, he'll do a really good job of it.
Well, maybe. Matthew asks about the ravens and how many there have been.
And all we find out is that there have been more than even Delirium had
said 11 or 12.
Noted.
There have been rather more than that, Matthew. And one of them went back to being a man again, Aristaeus of Marmora. We talked about him. He's been mentioned before, and he was a real person. And he's remembered for the letter of Aristaeus, in which he described the origin of the Greek translation of the Old Testament known as the Septuagint.
Mm-hmm.
And the letter's veracity of the creation is disputed, but it is itself the first known mention of the Library of Alexandria that we can find. Because the letter, whether the letter is real or not, we're not totally sure of. There's arguments by historians. But in the letter, whether or not the story contained is real. Sorry.
Okay.
But it is the first mention of the Library of Alexandria that we've got written down.
And so in Neil's fiction here, it's believed that that person was one of Dream's ravens and then was returned to human form, but it wasn't what he wanted.
And it's also possible, I think, that maybe the letter was something he brought back from the library, which means he brought back a not real letter, which is why its veracity is. I think Neil might be playing some clever history reference there that I'm not totally getting.
Okay.
Especially with, because Lucian's library is of things that weren't written.
Yeah.
And they're not, so.
Okay.
That could be going on.
Matthew's been asking Eve about the ravens, but she wouldn't tell him even if she knew.
Yeah, indeed. That is as it should be, Matthew. You may return to Eve's cave, Matthew. I shall send for you if I have need of you. And then he just teleports him back.
Yeah.
It seems like Morpheus does not like this line of questioning.
No.
Don't ask about them.
I don't think he likes being questioned at all.
That's true. I think that's true.
So this has always happened with Eve.
Mm-hmm.
If you watch her through these panels, she gets younger in every frame she's in.
Yep. Yeah, she
starts
very old.
So the first one outside the cave, she's got gray hair.
Yeah.
And then the next one, her hair is sort of a medium gray and her face has lines. Mm-hmm. And then the next picture of her, she just has that one streak of gray. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, she looks quite young.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Going through the ages backwards. That's kind of been her thing. She keeps changing, yeah.
Yeah.
And then we're outside the nightclub Lux. Lux is Latin for light.
And it's Lita again.
And she's wearing a little black dress.
Evening gloves.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this woman that she runs into,
mm-hmm.
she's wearing a mask that covers half her face.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's a porcelain mask.
Phantom of the Opera.
Yeah.
Oh, and they're in a place that plays show tunes. And she's wearing a mask that's like Phantom of the Opera.
Yeah. But also, who's inside? Well, let's get there. So she meets Eric. Eric is Eric Needham, a.k.a. the Black Spider. He's a Batman kind of anti-hero villain. He's a former drug addict who goes on a vigilante killing spree of drug dealers. So he's like Batman, but pushed too far into, he goes and murders them all, right? He finds the people selling heroin. So he was also kind of a good guy in that he was fighting the bad guys, right? The people pushing dope. But he was actually dead in the comics recently of an explosive suicide run against several drug kingpins who had murdered his wife and child. Like he had lured them all together and then suicide bombed them all and killed himself. So I'm not sure what he's doing here as this character trying to hire her.
Mm.
But I think what it is he's trying to hire her to be part of his kind of anti-criminal organization.
Okay.
Like not so much as a superhero. I think he's saying the truth when he's like, look, you'll make up your own job description. I think he generally wants somebody as superpowered as her on his side.
Okay.
And he's probably like Batman-y rich right now from whatever the superhero ways of making money are. And wants to hire her.
Okay.
Yeah. So he mentions that Lux has a no portable phone policy. Doesn't matter if you're Eisner or Ovitz. Michael Eisner was head of Disney Studios at the time that this was written. Michael Ovitz was a high-powered agent, and he actually became president of Disney 2 years after this issue.
Okay.
So they're both basically super powerful Hollywood types. So even they don't get to have their phones in here.
No.
Mm-hmm.
They're in a piano bar, and the waitress doesn't speak.
Mm-hmm. And the song that's being played, A Cigarette That Bears Lipstick Traces, An Airline Ticket to Romantic Places, is These Foolish Things Remind Me of You. And here's Nat King Cole's version.
Who is it written
by? Jack Strachey and lyrics by Eric Mashwitz.
An airline ticket to romantic places, and still my heart has wings. These foolish things remind me of you. A tinkling piano in the next apartment, those stumbling words that told you what my heart meant, a fairground's painted swings, these foolish things remind me of you.
He asks her if she'd like something to drink. She wants tomato juice. He calls it a Virgin Mary.
A what?
It's a Bloody Mary, just without the vodka.
I thought you were going to say without the blood.
No. Because, again, she's so damn violent. To me, this is more hints, right? Like, she's violent. She's hyper-aggressive anytime anybody challenges, right? She gets angry all the time, and all she can think of in her head is without the blood.
Yeah. She also looks very sad. Mm-hmm. These first little bit. She looks pretty sad.
She doesn't want to be out. She's thinking of other things, right? She's looking away all the time.
Yeah.
Which means she's not in the moment. And we find out why. She's worried about her son. This is the first time that she's been apart from her son since he's been born.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he has a dossier on her.
Mm-hmm. Cool idea, huh? Silent waitresses.
I thought she was actually dumb.
Maybe. Anyway, it gets her good tips from me. Who wants to hear women talk all the time?
What?
Hey, don't you go putting words into my mouth, little lady. Not just women, people. People talk all the time. I mean, don't you just hate a verbose waiter?
Not really.
Kind of a nice cover, dude.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to say this really sexist thing. And don't you put words in my mouth. I mean, people.
And the backstory he gives to Lyta here is pretty much it. Born sometime around 1960, mother was the Greek-born superheroine who called herself the Fury. No mention here of who your father was. As an infant, you were entrusted to Virginian couple the Trevors. That's how she has that as her maiden name, Lyta Trevor. They formally adopted you about 5 years later when it became apparent that wherever your mother had gone, she wasn't coming back. And then over the page, childhood sweetheart Hector Hall, he became the Sandman. Worked together in one of those hero groups. The hero group was called Infinity Inc. They had their own comic for a while. The rest, the engaged to be married, Hector died in 87, leaving her pregnant. She married him in 88. That's kind of strange. That's superhero-y strange, but we found out how that worked. She married him in the dream world where Brute and Glob had taken dead him.
Yeah.
And were trying to make him the new Sandman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the timeline's weird and he's acknowledging that.
Yeah. He doesn't seem too weirded out by it. He's just like, oh, that's weird.
And he acknowledges that she came back several years later, still pregnant with the same baby.
Yeah, Daniel. And been a mom ever since.
And then we cut over to the pianist.
Yeah. And he's being bothered by a guy from a couple.
In a checkered suit.
In a big checkered suit.
Very good, actually. I think we're supposed to think he looks not good. I think just what kind of way... I think you just get this impression from him.
Yeah.
But I actually love this suit, and I love the pink flower, and I love the tiny bow tie.
Well,
and the glasses. It's all
very
good.
I have something for you. Do you know who the pianist is?
Yeah, I think I figured it out.
Right. Who is it?
The pianist is Lucifer, and the girl with the mask is that
Mazikeen.
Dead girl with half a face.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool. Why she doesn't talk too, right? Because remember, she was like,
yeah.
That's how all her lines were.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he's no longer sitting on the beach. He's got a nightclub, and he plays show tunes.
Yeah, it's because you can tell it's definitely him because his lettering is in the different lettering that Lucifer had.
Exactly. He has that angelic lettering.
Yes, and he feels very strongly about cats the same way I do.
Hey, Mac, will you play Memories for my good lady over there from Cats? Her name's Vonda. You know, midnight all alone on a pavement, that one?
No. No, I'm afraid not. It is a song I find entirely devoid of interest. The melody is trite, while the awkward paraphrases of lesser Eliot poems in the lyrics are grating in the extreme.
Hey, bud, here's $50, says you'll play it. It's her birthday, and after Memories, how about Happy Birthday to Vonda?
I will not play Memory, and I cannot be bothered to lie. Vonda's birthday will be far from happy. However, I will play something appropriate enough, considering how this evening will end for you both.
Javi, is he going to play Memories? What did he say? I asked him.
This song is for a young lady named Vonda who's having a birthday tonight.
This song is called Sit Down, You're Rockin' the Boat.
From Guys and Dolls.
Written by Frank Lesser.
On a boat to heaven, and by some chance I had brought my dice along. And there I stood, and I hollered, someone save me. But the passengers, they knew right from wrong. For the people all said, sit down, you're rocking the boat.
People all said, sit down, you're rocking the boat.
And the devil will drag you under by the sharp lapel of your checkered coat. Sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down.
Sit down, you're rocking the boat.
And the devil will drag you under by the sharp lapel on your checkered coat.
Ah, sit down. You're rocking the boat.
Eric appreciates it. Mostly doesn't like show tunes. And Lyta instantly feels something is wrong.
Yeah.
She wants to go. He tries to talk her out of it. He then says, look, make a phone call. Make sure everything's okay. If it's not, I'll drive you there myself. Which I think is reasonable, right? Because we've been told by Carla. Carla's like, she's super weird about it and overprotective. So he's like, okay, let's be reasonable. Get you some. And then to his credit, She goes, nobody's answering. We have to go. And he's like, all right.
He also doesn't want his dinner to end. Like, he wants this meeting. He wants coming out of her. So if she leaves him, he's never going to get something out of her.
Yeah.
So now he's getting a favor.
He's being kind of respectfully pushy.
Yes.
Right? He's kind of doing it right, but also he has his own agenda that he's not getting to carry off.
Yeah. I mean, even the fact that when he was offering her the job, he said, you know, we can get caretaking even in the place and you get to make up all your decisions.
Yeah.
He's trying to embroil himself in her life in some way.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so this is another option for him to do that.
Yeah. I think he sees her as an asset, right? Because we know that they don't say it outright, but she has superpowers.
Yeah.
Right. She's not a Batman person. She is super strong and tough. And Eric Needham's like, hey, I can totally use somebody like that, you know, in my organization.
Yeah.
And probably also understands you don't have to hire somebody to be a superhero. You just need them around. So when the bad stuff happens, they'll step up and deal with it.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, write your own job description.
He has a sort of lingering goodbye with the waitress.
Yeah. And take something for yourself out of it, okay? He's good. He treats the help well. He likes the place. You know, he leaves the money. Because he's leaving, he doesn't want to just leave them hanging.
On the drive there, because it's raining, everyone suddenly forgets how to drive.
Yeah. I've been told that this means it's probably winter in LA because it's the only time that it ever rains there.
Yeah. They get to her place. She runs up the stairs. She's shaking so hard she can barely open the door.
Mm-hmm.
And she gets in there and he's gone.
And look at that close-up of her face. Daniel's gone. And her face, her entire face is framed by that panel so that the emotional impact is as heightened as it can be.
This is the only page that has an 8 panel.
Right, exactly.
It doesn't have 9 because something's missing.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Love it. Not a lot going on, but also potentially a lot going on.
Yeah.
What'd you think about this one?
I like it.
Yeah.
I like it way better than the last one, too.
Okay, I get that.
Yeah, this is, I think I'm going to like this whole...
We've been away from the dreaming, like not just the dreaming, but the Sandman has barely been mentioned in the Sandman for the last little while. And I think you can kind of get a feeling now that that was almost on purpose, knowing that you can kind of tell this one's going to be deep into the Sandman stuff. So that World's End was kind of a, let me get my stories out. Let me get all these other stories I wanted to tell done. And then here we go, diving deep into the kindly ones and taking our time. Okay, any guesses? They took my baby.
I don't think we're going to find anything about where Daniel is in the next arc.
Okay.
Or the next issue. I think that he's going to be a dangling missing that they're going to be hunting for.
Okay.
But we're not going to find out anything about it
yet. All right. I think that's a good guess.
Yeah.
Now, long-term prediction. Who do you think took Daniel? Why is Daniel not there anymore?
Maybe one of the demons, if they want the dreaming still.
Okay, so it could be somebody from hell, like somebody who wants... Well, he doesn't have the key to hell anymore, but it could be somebody seeking vengeance for sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know. I don't know. Yeah. No, I can't think of anyone.
Okay. So any predictions for what might happen next issue? I know it's pretty broad and open.
Yeah. Like, I know it's not going to... We're not going to... I think it's going to be... Lita trying to find, like searching for Daniel, but not getting leads, like not finding him at least right away.
Well, what do you do when your kid's been taken?
You go to the police.
Okay. Do you think she'll do that or do you think she'll superhero it up? And
I think she'll superhero it up and not go to the police. Okay. No, I think she will go to the police actually.
Yeah. I think you have to kind of report your kid being missing.
Yeah.
Right. And how well do you think they're going to do with that?
I think they're going to do crap job
right.
of it.
Yeah, okay.
Real bad.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, well, I guess we're going to have to find out next episode.
You've been dreaming of the Sandman, issue 57, The Kindly Ones, part 1. For show notes, visit thedreaming.motivedust.com. Support future episodes at patreon.com/thedreaming, and we'd sure appreciate it if you tell your friends about us. Our theme music is Oneri by Kai Engel. Hear more at kaiengel.bandcamp.com. The Dreaming was recorded in Burnaby, British Columbia, Canada, on the unceded territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, Kikate, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. I'm Joe Fulgham. Thanks for listening. Time to wake up.